Can oral anticoagulants reduce bleeding risk?
Can the Department of Justice improve care?
Will HPV testing replace pap smears?
And interfering with RNA to treat a progressive hereditary disease.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This will be posted on July 6th, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. And we're recording on July 4th. Happy Independence Day, Elizabeth.
And the same to you. I hope your fireworks are spectacular in El Paso. Since we're speaking of these sorts of national matters, then I'm going to let you lead off with this study I thought was really interesting in the Journal of the American Medical Association. When the Department of Justice looks into whether devices are being used, what happens to care?
I've not recall we've reported on a study like this before. In 2010, the U.S. Department of Justice really created a firestorm of controversy when it began to investigate hundreds of hospitals for fraud due to what was considered possible inappropriate placement of implantable cardiodefibrillators, or called ICDs. What happened was, in 2005, CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, determined what the appropriate use was for ICDs. And then what some whistleblowers noticed, but looking at the national data, it looked like as many as 25% of the defibrillators were put in without following these recommendations. And so they brought this to the attention of the U.S. Department of Justice. The Department of Justice looked at over 100 hospitals and ultimately fined them $280 million for inappropriate use. But as soon as the Department of Justice got involved, the inappropriate use declined by about 60 to 70%, not only in the hospitals involved in the settlement, but even those that weren't involved as well.
I think this is really very fascinating, and I'm going to ask our listeners to recall that last week, you brought out an aspect of a study we covered, which was the hospital at home study, and you said this is a place where fraud could possibly be rampant. This is a perspective that I don't have on this kind of literature. And that was one thing I thought about with this study. It's a perspective I don't have. That is, incentivizing physicians or surgeons to utilize devices just for gain.
There are two possible explanations. One is that, as you mentioned, this is frank fraud. The other is people just aren't paying attention to what the guidelines are. That may not be fraud. That's still sloppy. In either one of those cases, it increases the cost of healthcare and exposes the patient to treatments that may not be beneficial, in fact, may be harmful.
I'm interested in your speculation on how often you think this kind of care goes forward.
I think it happens more often than we'd like to think. Now, I'd prefer to think that we don't need the Department of Justice to get involved to fix this. But unfortunately, what this study showed is just releasing the guidelines improved things a little bit. But as soon as the hospital began to get investigated, there was a rapid decline in unnecessary use.
Well, since this one is so unique to us, this is the one that I will highlight on the blog this week. So since we're talking about heart matters, then let's take a look at direct oral anticoagulants, abbreviated DOACs, and risks of bleeding, ischemic stroke, venous thromboembolism, and all-cause mortality in a huge number of patients in the UK compared with warfarin or Coumadin use. I don't think it's surprising to either one of us that these direct oral anticoagulants have a lot of advantages. We've talked about this a lot. And so in this particular study, they had over 132,000 patients on warfarin, over 7,000 on dabigatran, 37,000 plus on rivaroxaban, and 18,000 plus on apixaban. They grouped these into two groups, with and without atrial fibrillation, and they took a look at all of these outcomes. They said, okay, we can see that apixaban is associated with a decreased risk of major bleeding events in patients with atrial fibrillation and without, compared to warfarin. Rivaroxaban also is associated with a decreased risk of intracranial bleeds in patients without atrial fibrillation. And then rivaroxaban and low-dose apixaban are associated with an increased risk of all-cause mortality in patients with atrial fibrillation and without, in comparison to warfarin. That's something that I'm finding inexplicable. When I read the discussion of this particular study, I can't explain why those would be associated with an increased all-cause mortality.
So as you said, the virtue of this study is it's a real-world setting. And in the real-world setting, the DOACs have a decreased risk of major bleeding. The patient populations, because it wasn't randomized, are a little bit different. So the patients that received DOACs were a little bit older and they had more risk factors. That could account for it. And as we try to control for that, but sometimes we can't get it all and we don't understand all the, quote, confounders. The other thing this study didn't do is we're not able to assess whether patients actually adhere or were compliant with. We just know it was prescribed for them. And the DOACs, if there's premature discontinuation of them, it increases the risk. They clearly have a decreased risk of major bleeding. And in those individuals that have a higher risk for it, particularly the older individuals, these appear to be the safer agents.
We've talked about many times the advantage of the DOACs over warfarin is that you don't have to keep on bringing somebody in and bringing them to Coumadin Clinic. Oh, let's look at your INR and see if you're okay. And the other thing is that we have established ways to reverse them quickly if somebody needs to have surgery. So to me, it seems like there's some pretty profound advantages.
It's easier to reverse Coumadin than it is all the DOACs. In this real-world setting, despite the fact that Coumadin may be easier to reverse, it's the DOACs that are safer. So I agree. The nice thing is this is a real-world setting.
And what are you doing with your patients today?
I discuss the benefits and harms of both therapies. For individuals who have to pay out of pocket, the Coumadin is much less expensive than the DOACs. Most patients prefer to be on an agent where they don't have to have their blood drawn. But if I'm concerned about compliance, using Coumadin, I can measure the INR and determine whether they're taking it or not. The other thing I'd remind individuals of, for those that have mechanical valves, DOACs are not recommended.
Let's turn to your other one. The use of so-called oligonucleotides in this very rare disease. I guess one of the things I'm thinking about with regard to this is just this whole strategy of the use of RNAs and all that to intervene in genetic diseases. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
And there are two articles related to these studies. These are patients that have a condition called amyloidosis. It's a condition where a protein that's made in the liver is mutant, and as a result, it unfolds and it gets deposited in the nerves or in the heart. The unfortunate thing about this is hereditary. It progresses over the course of years, but once someone has developed neuropathy, their survival is 2 to 15 years, and once they've developed cardiomyopathy, the lifespan is 2 to 5 years. It would be nice if we could actually interfere with the production of this protein. That's what these two studies did. And they did it by using things that interfere with RNA. One given subcutaneously, one given intravenously. What they were able to show is it improves neurologic function, it increases quality of life, and in one study, it appeared to reverse some of the cardiomyopathy associated with it as well. So even though this is a rare condition, this novel use of interfering with RNA is really what's important. And I'm glad you picked these two studies that show the same effects.
It makes a lot of sense to me because, gosh, all of our attempts to actually modify the genome seem like they're not really working out that well, and there's so many checks and balances. Why not just go right to this strategy and try to create modification? One thing that was interesting here to me was that only 60% of the patients in either of these two studies responded to the treatment. Maybe this means that we need to understand more of this genetic underpinning, even though this seems like it's really pretty straightforward.
We may not have the right dose for everybody. It may take a longer time to treat. We didn't have biomarkers. We assessed their neurologic function using clinical things. They may not be as sensitive as we'd like.
And I think we're going to see a whole lot more of this RNA interference strategy going forward. Finally, let's turn to something else that's been around for a while, which is in the Journal of the American Medical Association. What I suggested might be the replacement of pap smears using HPV-related technology. In this study in Canada, so we have to give a shout out to Tom. Hey, Tom, up there in the northern climes. This study took a look at over 19,000 women who were randomized either to have HPV testing or have regular old pap smears. And these were women who didn't have a history previously of any cancer in the cervix that was of any significance. Women who got the HPV testing, when they had results that were negative, they returned at 48 months of follow-up, where women in the regular old pap smear testing with liquid-based cytology If those results were negative, they returned at 24 months. At the end of the study, both groups received HPV and liquid-based cytology co-testing. The upshot of this whole thing is that those women who had primary HPV testing compared with cytology had significantly lower likelihood of invasive cervical neoplasia at 48 months.
The concern about this is there will be women that test positive for HPV, but they don't develop cervical neoplasia. But if you screen them early, it exposes them for further follow-up. So what the study showed was there were more false positives early on, but at the end of 48 months, those who proceeded with the HPV testing were less likely to have cervical neoplasia. I think, as you suggested, the study is really very interesting and suggests that when available, the HPV screening can replace pap smears in the future.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.